morning, Council. We'll now hear argument in the third case on the calendar this morning, A24-1075, State versus Magruder. A few quick housekeeping matters. For Council, you'll each be given 15 minutes for your argument this morning, and then appellant, you'll have 5 extra minutes for rebuttal. Please feel free to adjust the height of the podium if you so choose, using the buttons on the front. And before beginning your argument, if you could please identify yourself and your client for the record. So with that, we'll start with appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sarah Gadd, and I represent the appellant in this case, Madarian Magruder. This case arises from the tragic shooting of Taisha Gills in the early morning hours of July 31st of 2021. The state charged Mr. Magruder with second-degree intentional murder, second-degree felony murder, felony domestic assault, and manslaughter, based unilaterally on the testimony of one witness, Kiara Gills, the victim's cousin, who was the only person who was present when this shooting happened. A thorough review of the record shows that the district court's findings when he adjudicated Mr. Magruder guilty of all counts was clearly erroneous and against the manifest weight of the evidence and constituted a clear abuse of discretion. The trial court's ruling rests on a foundation that absolutely crumbles under the weight of the evidence. It was a verdict built on contradictions, misstatements, and a complete failure to scrutinize the record.
But counsel, looking at the district court's order, it seems to me to not just rest on the one witness, in addition to obviously officers and experts. Mr. Magruder testified, and the district court weighed the evidence in that it did identify that there were some inconsistencies in TG's testimony and had an explanation for those inconsistencies. Given the deference we give to the finder of fact, whether it's a jury or the bench in this matter, how does this court get to finding or saying that those findings are clearly erroneous given the exercise the court did in taking TG's testimony and identifying that she did have a different story, but then explaining what that different story was and why it was, and then crediting her? Isn't that exactly what the district court should be doing in this case? And in our role as an appellate court, how do we reverse the district court, given that they were able to see both witnesses and make those credibility determinations?
Absolutely, deference is given to the district court when it comes to issues concerning foundation evidence and the credibility of witnesses. The witness stated that she had lied about her knowledge of the incident because she was intimidated by the presence of one of Mr. Magruder's friends who had been socializing with them earlier that evening, and then grew concerned when the victim, Taisha Gills, began recklessly racking the slide of Mr. Magruder's firearm, ejecting unspent bullets all over the place, and he left with a warning. Mr. Collins said, "You're going to shoot somebody."
But again, counsel,
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was just about to make the point.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but again, she indicated that she was, she lied or she changed her story because she was nervous about the friend Montana. And the district court then supports that with the body camera footage of the officer. And again, indicated that based on that, I find her story reasonable. Again, given that exercise, how do we then say that all of that is clearly erroneous?
So first and foremost, Montana was not present when the witness, Kiara Gills, was speaking to police. He was only there immediately after she called 911. He walked right up to the officer and identified himself and asked what was going on because he had just left and the atmosphere was playful. It was only after she professed to feeling safe that she began to provide exculpatory information, that this was an accident. She said this repeatedly and consistently in all of her interviews outside the presence of Montana, and her testimony only changed at trial.
Can I interrupt just for a minute, Annick, because I want to respect your time for your argument. And you marshaled the facts in your brief, I think, you know, in a very convincing way in some respects about these inconsistencies. But the part that I am concerned about is the standard of review, and you asked us to apply a clearly erroneous standard, and the state has argued against that. So it's been, I think, pretty well-founded in Minnesota law and was just repeated in a case called State v. Isaac, 9 Northwest 3812, 2024 by the Supreme Court, that applying the circumstantial evidence standard of review at the first step, the court said it preserves the fact finder's credibility findings and recognizes that the fact finder is in a unique position to determine the credibility of witnesses and weigh the evidence before it. As the sole judge of credibility, the fact finder is free to accept part and reject part of a witness's testimony. So my concern, and why I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that before maybe pivoting to your circumstantial evidence sufficiency argument, is that I don't think we get to do what you're asking us to do at all, and that is to reweigh the evidence and question the credibility, because the determination by the district court, because the Supreme Court has very clearly said that the fact finder's credibility findings are preserved, and they're the sole judge of credibility, not us. So no matter how much we might agree with the points you made in your brief, we can't do anything about that because the credibility determinations were made, and that is the province of the district court.
The credibility determinations that were made by the district court were not just clearly erroneous, they were just frankly bizarre and reveal a troubling level of carelessness in evaluating the evidence. One particularly egregious example was the testimony of the victim's mother, Lakita Griffin, who testified that...
But before you go into the facts, I'm just saying legally, you know, from the appellate standard of review, how do we get to do the analysis you're asking us to do when the Supreme Court has said we resolve all questions of fact in favor of the fact finder's verdict? The first step of the test preserves the fact finder's credibility findings. So the fact finder clearly found TG to be, I mean, not TG, but it was, I think, KG to be credible. And once that happens, we are stuck with that on appeal. So I'm wondering if you have a case that says that that's wrong, because I looked at the cases you cite in your standard of review, and some of them were civil cases. One of them was a Supreme Court case that I don't know that stood for the proposition that you're asking us to adopt. And then, you know, you did cite the Palmer case, which says we apply the same standard in bench trials as jury trials, but Palmer, the standard Palmer was talking about was the sufficiency of the evidence standard, which includes what I'm citing to you here. So I just want to be sure. If there's another case we should consider that says we get to do a clearly erroneous analysis, this would be our opportunity to raise it. Otherwise, you could address the sufficiency of the evidence argument, the second part of your brief.
So the case law, Minnesota case law, has consistently held that evidentiary rulings concerning materiality, foundation, remoteness, relevancy, and the cumulative nature of the evidence is within the district court's sound discretion, yes, unless the district court's factual findings are contrary to the weight of the evidence and where the court's discretion has clearly been abused.
Are you citing a civil case?
I am citing Rogers versus Moore.
Civil case.
And Johnson versus Washington County. State versus Pack, State v. Horst.
And it is a little confusing because I think, you know, in the post-conviction context, when it's not a jury trial, it's an abuse of discretion standard, and you have to look, jury trial bench, but the initial trial, it's the sufficiency of the evidence standard, I think, unless there's something else. So that's why I was thinking maybe you might want to pivot to that argument.
Well, I just clearly wanted to point out an example of the district court's abuse of discretion, and that was with the testimony of the victim's mother, Lakita Griffin, who testified that the appellant called her the morning of the murder and said that the victim had shot herself. And when she was pressed about this at trial on why she did not tell the detective this when she had her first phone call with him, why that she did not say anything about the appellant, Mr. Magruder, saying that the victim had shot herself, the district court found that it was not sufficient enough to impeach her credibility because the victim's mother made that statement to an unknown detective who did not testify. That detective was the lead detective who led the investigation into Taisha Gill's death, who not only testified, but he testified about this exact conversation that he had with Ms. Griffin.
Counsel, I see you have 5 minutes, and I really want to pivot you to the circumstantial evidence part of your argument, because I do have some concerns and some questions about that. And I guess my first question is, it seems to me that the circumstantial evidence argument that you're making rests on this regarding the district court's kind of credibility determinations. If we take the district court or take the facts giving weight to the district court that support kind of the fact that he committed second degree intentional homicide, what facts, looking at that as a whole, would you point to me that would support your argument that your alternative argument, that being that the gun accidentally went off and that was the cause of the death?
Yes. So as I stated, everybody was intoxicated that night, and there was horseplay involving a stun gun, BB guns, and Mr. Magruder also had a firearm that he carried with him for protection. The victim grabbed Mr. Magruder's firearm and began racking the slide, ejecting bullets from it, and...
And I'm sorry to interrupt you. Again, as we're identifying the facts to do the circumstantial evidence, we have to give deference to the district court's argument or the district court's findings. And my understanding is the district court found Mr. Magruder not credible as it relates to kind of the facts leading to that. The district court's finding was that particularly that Mr. Magruder stated that he was going to pop TG, which she then testified stood for he was going to shoot her. He then grabbed his gun, racked the gun. Again, there's not testimony that he actually chambered a bullet, but I presume the inference is that when he racked the gun, it chambered a bullet. And then he followed that with another statement saying, I'm going to pop you if this happens. That's followed by a taser sound, followed by the gun shooting. I think one reasonable inference is he said, I'm going to shoot you if you play with the taser. She played with the taser. He said it again, and he shot her, which isn't reasonable inference as it relates to second-degree murder. My question is, within this set of facts, what are the facts that would support the hypothesis or the alternative that this was an accident? Was there any evidence that in the record that supported that the gun went off from recoil? Was there any evidence in the record that supported an alternative explanation to this factual situation?
The evidence does not support the state's theory that Mr. Magruder was standing over her when she was sitting on the couch. It supports the position that Mr. Magruder had just wrestled the firearm out of Taisha's hand to stop her from potentially shooting somebody.
And he gave her a sincere warning. What facts, like when we point to the record, where in the record does that information come from? Is that Mr. Magruder's testimony? Is that KG's testimony? Where does that come from? Because if it is Mr. Magruder's testimony, and particularly the court found that that's not credible, then aren't we, for the circumstantial evidence argument, to disregard that in identifying the facts that we need to use in order to determine whether or not there's a reasonable alternative?
Mr. Magruder testified to this. There were 4 unspent bullets found in the top drawer of Taisha's dresser. Now, Kiara had testified that Mr. Magruder had only been at her place a couple of times. The ammunition that was found in the top drawer of Taisha's dresser was exactly the same type of ammunition from his gun, which suggests that Kiara cleaned...
But again, counsel, I'm sorry to keep pressing this. These are all facts that the district court disregarded as either not credible or... not believable, so...
But there was testimony from the BCA analyst.
And what I'm saying is, for us to do a circumstantial evidence analysis, the standard is that we gather the facts in the light most favorable to the verdict with due regard for the district court's credibility finding. So if we do that, at least for that first step, we have to disregard all the, at least my understanding, you can point me to case law if I'm incorrect, is that we have to disregard all of the facts that the district court indicates that are not credible, that they hold out. So looking at the facts that the court identified as the facts to support this, again, and I get there's testimony, I get that Mr. Magruder testified, and I get that generally, it seems to me like there may be some hypothesis, but again, looking at the circumstances proven, what facts within those circumstances proven with due regard for the district court do we use to support the alternative hypothesis?
So the trajectory of the bullet, it entered Taisha's chest and then it traveled through her body at a steep downward angle and lodged in her gluteal region, which is inconsistent with somebody just standing over somebody pointing a gun at them. It suggests, and the biomechanics expert that that testified for the defense discussed what's called a jump avoidance theory, where Mr. Magruder instinctively jumped to avoid getting tased yet again with a stun gun while he was holding a firearm that had a bullet in the chamber because the victim had, as I mentioned before, had been racking the slide and ejecting bullets on the floor. And then when the BCA crime analyst was going through the home, she noted that there were bullets that were not just from his gun. It was a very rare brand of ammunition that she had never seen before, which makes it highly unlikely that it did not come from Mr. Magruder's firearm for the exact scenario that he testified to that the district court summarily disregarded as non-credible, even though his testimony was the only testimony that had been consistent from day one. From day one, even Kiara said this was an accident. There was no tension. This was absolutely, we were just playing. This was an accident. She references Taisha messing with the gun at one point. It was only until trial that her testimony drastically changed.
So, and if we take your, let's just go, like, take your point that the bullets did come from his, that there's at least there's a rational a possibility that the bullets came from his firearm that night. How does that, so even let's take that as a circumstance proved or a theoretical, maybe not, it's a possibility, right? And when we're looking at other rational possibilities for what could have happened based on these circumstances proved. How does that, we still have to take KG's testimony that he was serious now, he wasn't playing anymore. He was serious and he seemed to mean what he was saying about don't tase me again or I'm gonna pop you. The fact of those bullets, maybe that they had been horsing around, even if hypothetically she had been playing with his gun. How does that, like, given that the circumstances seemed to change based on KG's testimony that they were no longer playing, he was now serious. Well, I'm just trying to get the relevance of the bullets in that world that we're in, where we have to accept her testimony that he was serious now, even if they were playing before.
Because it suggested that Mr. Magruder was actually telling the truth about why there was still a bullet in the chamber when the firearm discharged, when she tased him. He said it was an accident. He didn't have even a moment to put a safety on his firearm because she literally started tasing him while he had just wrestled it out of her hand. And so the district court disregarded that testimony as non-credible, disregarding the bullets entirely, even accepted her testimony that they were not shooting Mr. Magruder with BBs, with a BB gun. And it was only after the court issued a verdict that the defense counsel brought this up and said there actually were BBs found on the living room floor.
So does the bullets, just to like drill down this one point, the presence of the bullets, to the extent that we could accept a hypothetical possibility that they were from his gun and were evidence of horseplay, really it goes to whether the bullet was in the chamber or not, even though she, because there is that that's the fact that then it shows the bullet was in the chamber unintentionally, or that he had, is that?
Not exactly, okay. Because Kiara had testified that Mr. Magruder was, or that Taisha was not playing with his gun. She said we were not playing, she was not playing with his gun, we were not shooting BBs at them, and this supports Mr. Magruder's testimony, even though the district court summarily disregarded it as non-credible. It supports what he said about why the bullet was in the chamber and why, essentially, this tragedy happened. It was clearly an accidental shooting, and this is coming from the state's key witness who said over and over and over again, immediately after the shooting, early on in the investigation, later stages of the investigation, she gave like 3-4 interviews maintaining that this was an accident, and
I don't mean it, but I think I understand that point. Your time has expired. Are there okay. Further questions from the panel? You'll be able to come back for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. My name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, appearing for the respondent to the state of Minnesota. I think I'll begin just by trying to clarify something. As far as this court's review goes, the gun was never in Mr. Magruder's hand. This court has to assume that the truth of the state's witnesses, and it has to defer to the district court's credibility determinations.
Do you mean it was never in TG's hand?
Did I say the victim's hand?
Yeah, you said the gun was never in Mr. Magruder's hand? Just want to...
thank you, Your Honor. Yes, the gun was never in the victim's hand. Okay. I appreciate that. And the reason I want to lead off with that is because every time this morning when counsel was asked about facts, the big fact was Mr. Magruder's testimony that the victim had racked the gun several times. And so I think their argument really does boil down to the only way we can win on a sufficiency analysis is if this court finds the district court's credibility determinations to be clearly erroneous.
I mean, that's part of, I think, the struggle that every appellate defense attorney has when confronting the circumstantial evidence test, right, is this requirement that we winnow down the evidence to the subset of facts that's consistent with the verdict. When you apply that really strictly, depending on the type of case, it's pretty difficult sometimes to point to a reasonable inference when you just zoom in on a narrow set of facts, you know, and we don't get to consider Mr. Magruder's testimony that she lunged at him. We don't get to consider the racking of the gun, putting the bullets on the floor, or how they ended up in the drawer in the bedroom, right? We just think about the narrow set of facts that supports the verdict. And so, I mean, what is the limit of that winnowing in the state's view?
Yeah. So the first thing is that is a function of the finality of the jury's verdict, the presumption of regularity that we attach to a verdict. All of that goes into the standard of review. And you've just described, I think accurately, that that's the hard part about these cases on appeal. There is a limit, however. And it's not just that we can disregard every fact that the state doesn't like on appeal. That's not what the rule is. And I'll point the court to State versus Colgrove. It was a case where the defense was intoxication, and there was a lot of evidence that the defendant was highly intoxicated at the time of the offense. He had been on a methamphetamine bender for a while. And the state argued on appeal, you don't even get to consider that fact. That's out because it's not a fact that we like. And the Supreme Court said, no, that fact is still part of the circumstances proof because that's not inconsistent with the jury's verdict. You can still have a fact that's favorable to the defense, but is still consistent with guilt. And so I think that's the line that the Supreme Court is trying to draw. We're going to look at what facts are inconsistent with guilt. Now, I think it's a little different here because we then are also talking about credibility. And when you have a defendant testifying that the victim was playing with the gun and the victim caused me to accidentally fire, you also have to account for the fact that the jury heard that testimony, or in this court, in this instance, the district court, and didn't find it credible.
What about the lunging? Is the lunging necessarily inconsistent? Not the setting aside the playing with the gun, because she's got a stun gun in her hand. That is part of the circumstances proved, right? I mean, clearly, the shot following the stun gun firecracker sound going off is part of our circumstances proved, no matter what.
Right.
So it does become a lot different of a case for reasonable inferences if Mr. Magruder's testimony, and it seems to come, well, actually, even KG, who the district court found credible in all respects, said at some point she was lunging. She agreed with defense counsel. She didn't specifically say, from what I read in the transcript where counsel talked about it, that happened right before the shooting, but she said there was horseplay going on. She later said things got serious. So is the lunging part of the circumstances proved?
I don't think it is, and I'm going to go to the timing for that proposition, because there's certainly testimony from the cousin that there was lunging. I mean, they were playing around with the taser. That had been going on for a little while. What the cousin testified to is that once Mr. Magruder made the threat to shoot and pulled out his gun, she stood up because she doesn't want any part of this anymore. And she turns her back and she begins to walk towards her bedroom. And this is one of the reasons I put those photos in my brief. You can see the door is 2 or 3 feet from where she was sitting. Before she reaches the door, the gun is going off.
I'm sorry to interrupt. When she gets up and walks away, she also indicates to them, y'all tripping before she's walking away. That doesn't seem to be consistent or inconsistent with the facts to support the verdict, but it also somewhat supports, at least that statement, a reasonable inference that they were horsing around, particularly when her testimony is, at least on direct examination, that they were seriously playful. So she just didn't, on recross, she testifies that he was serious, but on direct, she testified that they were seriously playful. So it seems to me her testimony, if we find it to be credible, supports that they were horsing around, they were seriously playful, whatever that means, and that because they were tripping or being seriously playful, she was walking away. Why wouldn't that, given some of the other inferences we can draw, for example, an inference that when he says, stop playing, where he threatens to pop her, one reasonable inference isn't that he's going to shoot her, but it's a reasonable inference that he's trying to get her to stop playing around with the taser. Isn't that fair?
I think he was probably doing both. Okay. It was a bona fide threat. We know it's a bona fide threat because he did, in fact, shoot her when the condition of the threat occurred, when she activated the taser again. But I think going to your testimony, and I'm sorry, I'm not trying to cut you off.
Oh, no, go ahead, please.
Going to your point about the cousin's testimony, and at times she's talking about being playful, time she said, no, I took this really seriously. I think on the standard of review, that's where we get to you reconcile conflicting pieces of information in favor of the verdict.
Even if the district court found her credible in all respects, that doesn't mean we're stuck with the entirety of her testimony to the point that Judge Harris is making, that there's some conflict there?
Oh, so point taken, Your Honor. I think the court did say in all respects. I think the standard for sufficiency is the fact finder is free to disregard portions of one witness's testimony and credit other portions of their testimony. I think the way I look at this, when we have a case that involves a district court's findings, is to be blunt about it, as an appellate attorney for the state, I'm never actually too concerned with what the district court particularly outlines in its order, because this court's role in a sufficiency analysis is to independently review the facts. And if it is the case, which it is clear across precedent, that the standard applies the same between district court or bench trials and jury trials, that's the approach we have to take. Once we go down this road of saying, well, the district court said this, and it said this, and that's going to affect our analysis, we are no longer applying a unified standard of review to both contexts.
The factual findings don't really matter.
I don't think they do. I think you still look at it as if it was a jury trial.
I mean, he could have not said anything about credibility, and just with the verdict, we would have to determine that, because that's what happens with juries all the time. We don't know what the jury thinks is credible or not. We don't have, right?
Correct, Your Honor. I mean, I think there is a criminal rule that talks about, you know, the district court has to make findings following a bench trial. But if we're in the context of sufficiency, we should be looking at this exactly as we would a jury trial. And let me give you one sort of just more thought about this. One of the reasons is because, let's say the problem you have with the district court's order is that you're just not compelled by the reasoning of the order. There's some funky things going on here. There was an error made and the district court corrected it later. And so that's the reason why you would want to reverse that order. Not because there isn't, on a sufficiency standard, sufficient evidence, but because you're just concerned enough about the order. The problem with that is that reversing when the claim is sufficiency carries with it a double jeopardy bar against re-prosecution. And so if you're reversing just because of the nature of the district court's order, I think that creates really thorny questions about, okay, what happens on remand? So you haven't reversed because the evidence was insufficient. You've reversed for some other reason. And so I think we should always be looking at these two scenarios, bench trials and jury trials, identically for the application of the circumstantial
this
evidence
is why
standard
you're not,
of review.
You're not arguing that the direct evidence standard, like the district court applied to intent by drawing the negative inference from his testimony, applies. You're just arguing for circumstantial
Correct.
Evidence.
Correct, Your Honor. I'm not concerned with the fact that, to be in all candor, I had some problems with the way the district court went about applying the circumstantial evidence standard of review. But I just don't think it matters, because this court's role is to independently review the entire record and determine whether the state met its burden beyond a reasonable doubt. The theory on appeal doesn't even have to be the same theory that the prosecution had below. The only question, because this is sufficiency and because of the nature of a sufficiency and the consequences of a finding of insufficient evidence, it's just in the abstract, did the state's evidence satisfy the proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard? That's all we're asking.
So let me ask you, the state, at least in your brief, would agree that this accidental discharge theory is at least a theoretical possibility. It's possible under the facts.
It is remote, but theoretically possible.
Okay, so I'm kind of curious about the line between what turns something from a remote possibility into a reasonable one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here we knew that they were playing around, presumably, especially with the testimony that KG offers, the victim, there's no reason to think the victim wasn't still playing around. There's no testimony or evidence that she became serious and was really trying to in fact, based on the sound of the stun gun, never actually made physical contact, right? And maybe even to that point, I mean, the statement of intent that the state relies on here is, I think, something along the lines of, if you tase me, I'll pop you. And she doesn't actually ever tase. She just continues to hit the stun gun. And unlike some of the cases, you know, that involved, you know, the other circumstantial evidence that are discussed in the briefs, where there's an eyewitness, somebody's holding a gun to someone's head and say it accidentally went off. There were eyewitnesses saying they saw the gun being held. I mean, there was a little bit more evidence. So here we don't have anybody actually looking at the moment that it happened. We have the fact that they were playing, she was still playing. And, you know, she didn't actually tase him, which is what the threat was. So why isn't that enough to get over this remote possibility threshold?
In part, because... Well, I guess I'll lay out, because I think this just points back to where I was going to go eventually with just, like, what are our best facts.
Yeah.
So here's the sequence. So appellant expressly threatens to shoot the victim if she tases him. He pulls the gun from his waistband with his dominant right hand. Third, and this is probably the most critical thing. There's two critical things, but this might be the most critical. He racks the gun to load around into the chamber so that it can be fired. So what does that say about the threat that he had just made? Not that he's horsing around, not that he's saying that in jest. He's racking the gun because he is preparing to shoot. It cannot shoot if he doesn't do that. Then the fourth fact is, recall, the first fact was his threat, and the threat was predicated on a condition about the taser. When that condition occurred, when the taser goes off, he immediately shoots her. And so when we talk about what is a realistic possibility of inference, when somebody makes a threat, they prepare to carry out that threat, and then the condition of the threat occurs and they carry out the threat, we are in the land of wildly remote possibilities of inference. And what the Supreme Court has said is theoretical possibilities of inference are not enough. All the state has to do is eliminate the possibility of reasonable inferences.
Counsel,
and when you have...
Couldn't you take that same analysis and as it relates to the reasonable inference, turn it on the head? So you say there's a threat that he threatened to shoot her. One, I think it's reasonable that he... It's possible that it's reasonable that he was attempting to get her to stop, in essence, playing with the taser. Again, as it relates to the racking the gun, and quite frankly, I think I'd like to hear from Ms. Gadd, because that's the fact that is the toughest to get around. The question is, I don't know if there was ever testimony regarding whether or not he chambered the gun. There was testimony that he racked the gun. I'm not familiar with guns, whether or not racking it automatically means it chambers it, and maybe that's just an inference we draw. But again, then that's followed by, again, another threat, that being, stop tasing me, followed by a taser, which I think it's reasonable that if someone is coming near you with an electrical current, it's reasonable that you could jump or, you know, something can happen and the gun can go off. Again, that seems to me going to Judge Bentley's point. At what point is it a hypothesis versus something that is reasonable, given that each one of those facts, looking at the record as a whole, and when I say that, they were there together, quite frankly, they were in a relationship. There was testimony that they were going back there to engage in relationship stuff. There was testimony that they were all having a good time and they're intoxicated. It seems to me more reasonable that it was an accident versus that at some point he turned it on and decided to shoot the person who he was there to have a sexual relationship with. It seems to me like, where's that line?
Yeah. Your Honor, could I answer? It might be a little bit of a lengthy answer because I have...
That's fine.
It was a lengthy question. Sorry about that.
No, I appreciate it, Your Honor. So first, I want to address the racking of the gun. I think you're right. We didn't have any sort of firearms testimony about the operation of the gun. So let's put that aside and think about what that says about Mr. Magruder's intentions. You take out a gun and you rack it. I think no matter what, you are trying to convey the severity of what you're doing. I am being serious. This is grave. I've racked the gun. Has an effect on the other people, and that's your intent. Secondly, you mentioned the possibility that there was lunging towards Mr. Magruder and that he shot accidentally. If it was a circumstance proved that she lunged at him from a standing position, that would be a proper way to analyze it. The cousin testified that the victim was in a seated position when she got up off the couch, and that when the cousin turned around and she had been shot, she was in the same spot on the couch. So from that, we can reasonably infer that she did not get up off the couch and from a standing position lunge at Mr. Magruder. There was a third point I had, Your Honor, but I've... But the last point is, let's put aside the racking of the gun, like I said before. If you just think about what are natural inferences from when somebody makes a conditional threat, and then moments later, when the condition of the threat occurs, the threat is carried through with, what would we infer from that? I think the only reasonable inference from that is that the threat was serious, the person who carried out the threat intended to carry it out, and that the idea that you would make a conditional threat and then accidentally carry it out immediately after the condition occurs, we're again in the land of just wildly implausible possibilities. And that's not a basis for reversal under the circumstantial evidence standard of review. I simply ask this court to affirm the conviction. Thank you.
So one point that also supports the fact that supports Mr. Magruder's version of events was the presence of stippling and soot on the entrance wound on the victim, which suggested that Mr. Magruder was no farther than 6 inches away when this happened.
Well, it's like 6 inches to 2 feet or something like that, right?
It was within very close range, and the report went on to specify that soot and stippling indicates very close range.
Is that a fact consistent with the guilty verdict?
I'm sorry?
Is that fact consistent with the guilty verdict?
No.
Then we don't get to consider it. If it's not consistent with the guilty verdict, we don't get to consider it as part of the circumstances proved. So if it is consistent with the guilty verdict, then we can draw an inference from it.
Okay. And then one other point about just the forensic evidence was the trajectory of the bullet. It's not, there was testimony at trial. The biomechanics expert testified that the jump avoidance theory that entailed Mr. Magruder instinctively jumping to avoid being zapped was more consistent with the trajectory of the bullet.
But counsel, that same expert also testified that the trajectory of the bullet was also consistent with Mr. Magruder intentionally shooting. So again, and maybe we're just, it seems to me that step one of this circumstantial evidence kind of process is where I'm hung up with your responses. It seems to me that we need to gather only the facts as it relates to those that support the verdict. So, yes, the testimony that it is consistent with the jump avoidance theory, but does that fact support the verdict? And if it doesn't, then are we prohibited from utilizing it in our analysis?
I'm honestly not quite sure what the question is.
So there's a two-step process. We need to identify the facts as it relates to the facts that the court relied on in coming to a verdict, the circumstances proved. In the state's brief, they identified 26 facts. You identified, in essence, 10 facts. And the facts, it seems to me, that we all identify are that Mr. Magruder, the victim and the cousin were joking around earlier in the night, that at some point they were horsing around with a taser, that moments before the shooting, Mr. Magruder threatened to pop TG if she didn't stop activating the sun gun, that he racked the gun, that after he racked the gun, he then threatened again to pop or shoot her. At that point, the only other eyewitness was turning to leave, so we don't have any further testimony as it relates to anyone seeing it. But what we hear next is that the stun gun goes off and the shot happens. Mr. Magruder flees. Mr. Magruder leaves the country. Mr. Magruder doesn't render aid. Mr. Magruder, these are the facts that support the verdict, giving all due consideration to the court's basically credibility findings. The facts that you are attempting to argue here, they don't support the verdict. And my question is, if they don't, then how do we have the ability to consider those facts? Because let's say I agree with you that it seems to me that instinctually this feels like this was just an accident. That's not the analysis we have to undertake. We have to take the facts that the court found and say, is it reasonable and are there facts to support that this was an accidental shooting? And it's only taking the facts that have been proven, the facts I just identified. So given the facts that I've identified, what in those facts support the theory or support the reasonable theory that this was an accidental shooting, and how do they support that reasonable theory?
I believe that the forensic evidence strongly supports that this was an accidental shooting, and obviously the most consequential aspect of Kiara's testimony is Mr. Magruder's actions once the gun was in his hand. This is the moment where the state needed to establish intent. And so Mr. Magruder's conviction rests almost entirely on her testimony, which has consistently changed. On July 31st, she said, "We were all joking, and I got up to go to the room. The shooting was an accident." In the following interview, she said, "There was no tension. And despite Mr. Magruder having a gun in his hand, he and Taisha were in the midst of playing when I went up to go to my room." And then at trial, she said she noticed a change in Mr. Magruder's demeanor and in an inexplicable sudden rage decided to shoot her. So when you rely pretty much unilaterally on the credibility of a witness versus and just summarily disregarding the forensic evidence, I mean, at least to me, that constitutes an abuse of discretion. And that's why I highlighted the example of the district court judge not recognizing that the lead detective who testified was the lead detective who testified. I mean, that suggests a troubling level of carelessness in evaluating evidence when you're saying that somebody who testified can't be impeached because something they said outside of court was said to an unnamed detective who did not testify, when that detective testified about that very conversation. And that's just one of the many examples of how the verdict in this case does not support the facts. And if the court is relying on circumstantial evidence, then it was required to apply a heightened standard of scrutiny, which it failed to do. And a conviction can't stand when the only evidence of intent comes from the credibility of one witness whose story has changed multiple times.
Thank you, counsel.
So for those reasons, we respectfully ask that you reverse the district court's verdict and remand this back to the district court for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your briefs and argument in this case. The case has been submitted, and we'll issue an opinion in the matter within the time prescribed by statute. So with that, it concludes our oral calendar this morning. We will recess in a bit in order to discuss the non-oral case. Today we have a class visiting, so we're actually not going to recess as a court. I'll ask the marshal to close the proceeding, and then we'll remain on the bench. As counsel takes your leave. Thank you.